This land is your land. This land is my land. From California to the New York Island. From the Redwood Forest to the Gulf Stream waters. This land was made for you.
Okay, everybody, welcome to, got some kind of feedback. Hopefully we can take care of that at the studio. I think we got that straightened out. Welcome to People Speak Radio Show, folks. This is your host, Charles Giuliani. I got some good news. Basima, the regular host, who's been out recovering from a heart attack, is actually going to be back hosting next week. She's going to be easing in, though. She won't be on every week. But we'll be hearing from her next week, so that's going to be something you're all going to want to be tuning in for. I'm sure you're going to be anxiously anticipating that. I know a lot of people have been wondering, asking how she's doing, and obviously she's doing a lot better. She'll be back once again next week. Anyway, for today, I want to introduce our guest, Margaret Flowers, Dr. Margaret Flowers. Not only has she been big with the Occupy movement, but she's also a pediatrician who's fighting for universal health care, something that we've yet to see in this country. It's, of course, been implemented all across Europe, up in Canada. And so she's here to share this with us, the importance of it, the reason why it's something that she feels we need. So with no further ado, let's welcome Dr. Margaret Flowers. Welcome, Doctor.
Great. Thank you for having me on tonight.
Great to have you. I guess, first of all, I'd like to get some background on you, with the Occupy movement. What kind of a role did you play in that?
Well, I and a number of other people started meeting back in January of 2011, and in April of 2011 was when we decided to organize an occupation of Freedom Plaza in Washington, D.C. We were very frustrated, and we worked on all different issues, and were frustrated by the fact that we all ran into the same obstacle, which is the corporate control of our political process, and felt that we really were going to need to come together in order to try to get at the root causes of why we weren't making any headway on our particular issues, and also really felt that we needed to develop a culture of resistance in this country much more. We were inspired by what was happening in Madison, Wisconsin, by what was happening around the world, and so we started organizing the occupation of Freedom Plaza. We had state coordinators in about 36 states that were organizing people to come to Washington, D.C., and then after Occupy Wall Street took off in September, because we were planning to start ours in the beginning of October, a number of our state coordinators stayed home and helped to get occupations going locally.
Excellent. So you're playing a pretty key role.
Well, we spent 6 months pretty much full-time organizing, writing about what was going on, trying to encourage people to take things to another level. And we really saw ourselves very much in solidarity with the people that were organizing in Wall Street. Some of our organizers participated in their planning meetings. We were there the first day with them. So it's great that things have taken off the way they have. Now it's really the job of all of us to channel that energy into effective actions that will really bring about change in this country.
Now, this isn't the focus of our conversation, but I was curious, what is going on with the Occupy movement? The impression of a lot of people is that essentially it's died out. Is that your opinion, or
not at all? We continue to run our website that we use to organize the Occupation of Freedom Plaza. It's October2011.org, or you can get there by OccupyWashingtonDC.org. We update it almost daily with actions that are going on around the country or things that people are planning. We do a weekly email newsletter that talks about what's going on. What has happened is, now the physical occupations aren't there, people have gone into the communities. They're working in small working groups focused on specific issues, so they're preventing foreclosures, encouraging people to move their money, fighting against mass incarceration. There's a lot of education going on, particularly this summer, a lot of teach-ins and social forums and things like that, because we're really in a stage of movement building and education.
So, but as far as the long term, like you said, the long term, you know, the tents being set up and whatnot, that's you're just changing direction, in other words.
Well, we, you know, when we were organizing Freedom Plaza, we really saw the physical occupation of space as a tactic, an initial way to make a statement that, you know, what was happening in this country, the direction that we're going is not acceptable. We never felt that that was the movement. It's, you know, more like a freedom ride. It's a part, it's a tactic that you use. The people that we were in contact with in the Spanish occupation, because we did work and continue to work with people in other countries as well, they really warned us not to continue an occupation longer than about 2 weeks. They felt that it started to lose its effectiveness after that point. Of course, there was so much excitement around, you know, the number of occupations that sprung up across the country that there was really a reluctance to for people to voluntarily close them down. So we tried to keep ours going for quite a while as well, just to keep in that spirit.
And of course, I know you're right. You know, there had been problems, you know, with police literally ordering people, you know, out of
right.
The
there were the yeah, there were the you know the shutdowns, but there was also internally there was a lot of infiltration going on, which is you know not unexpected. We were told that if you look at the amount of resources that were being put in overtly to shut down the encampments, that you could imagine there was about as many resources going into covertly get into the encampments and stir things up and infiltrate them and disrupt them. So, you know, the physical encampments do bring those challenges. And really what we're looking at, we saw this occupation as a first step in building what we think is necessary in this country is a long-term, nonviolent, broad-based movement that acts strategically to affect change in this country. And that was the first step.
Did you see signs of, I guess, what you could call provocateurism from police? Yeah, I know
well,
I've
always,
seen some YouTube videos that indicate that.
Absolutely. I mean, it's hard to tell exactly who the provocateurs are coming from. The one of the first actions that was done in Washington, D.C. in Freedom Plaza, there were two provocateurs that came from right-wing organizations who kind of rushed at the security guards and caused there to be a pepper spray incident. You know, when we started looking at all the different groups that were opposed to what we were doing, you know, there could be law enforcement infiltrators, there could be corporate security infiltrators, people from the major political parties that could be infiltrating. So, you know, we probably should have taken that a little bit more seriously in the beginning, but it's hard to really be sure when somebody is a provocateur or not unless they do
sure.
something very obvious. And so that actually became a focus. Kevin Zeese and I started writing a series of articles about infiltration and kind of how to recognize and deal with that. We did a survey of the occupations around the country to kind of get an idea if they were experiencing the same kinds of problems that we were hearing about.
You certainly can't tell from a YouTube video. I mean, it's anybody's guess. You know, you can... And they can be edited, too, to make them look the way you want. It's hard
right.
to say.
Right,
you know,
but it was pretty clear that there were those efforts that were going on to try to disrupt and
oh,
prevent
sure.
the Occupy movement from being effective.
Yeah, we know this happens. It has gone on with other things. You know, the protest, I remember specifically, not to get off on a tangent, but you probably heard of the WTO protests in Seattle in 1999. There was a lot of... not so much provocateuring, but on the part of the police, but stand down, you know, they weren't responding to, are you familiar with what went on there? That
yes.
was quite a fiasco. Yeah.
Yeah.
yeah the Black
yeah.
Bloc group and trying to discredit them. You know, they were infiltrating the black,
right.
the legitimate protesters. Yeah. So we know this stuff does go on.
Right. I mean, in the 1968 in Chicago with the Democratic National Convention, one in six
oh,
of
sure.
the protesters was a federal agent.
Yeah.
So
there's a long history of this type of thing.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
Something to be aware of. But anyway, anything more you wanted to say about the Occupy movement? I wanted to get into, of course, the main topic of discussion here, your work with pushing for national health care.
Sure. Well, I mean, they're all related. So
yeah,
I do encourage people not to, you know, just because things seem a little bit quieter now, and we don't expect the corporate media to really cover what's going on in the Occupy movement. We had that same problem in Washington when we met with reporters, you know, from like the Washington Post and told them all of this work that we were doing. They would focus on if there were rats in the camp or not, or who was falling in love with who, and not, you know, not the actual why we were there, what our strategy was, you know, what was going on in the country. So so I encourage people not to feel like things are really dying down, but to get hooked in to look at the Occupy websites. If you go to the Occupy Philly website or the Occupy New York website, you'll see just tremendous amounts of activities that are going on.
And while we're on that subject, any specific site that you wanted to plug? Any, you know, do you have your own website? Or?
Well, we do. Ours is October2011.org. And then another very useful one is called interoccupy.net. And that's really a place where people are organizing across states. So if someone has an action that they're doing, like the Occupy Our Homes groups organized through InterOccupy, you can get on there, you can read the news feed, you can get, you can attend teach-ins, phone calls that they have, conference calls, you can join in some of the organizing for actions that are going on. So it has a lot of information. It's interoccupy.net.
Interoccupy.net. Excellent. So here it is now. I guess you were a pediatrician, right? You're actually, you quit
still
that
am.
For a while?
I'm still licensed. I'm just not practicing.
Just not practicing, yeah.
Right,
you're pretty much dedicating yourself to activism, it looks like, huh?
That's correct. Yeah, that's a full-time job right now.
Excellent. So, you know, which came first, the chicken or the egg, the Occupy movement or the push, you know, for you to be involved with the push for national health care? Were they synonymous? Or?
My work for the Occupy movement really came out of the years of work that I did trying to push for a single payer, which, you know, that all started when I was in practice. And I was really, the system that we have in this country really pushes us in the direction of providing poorer quality care, or our patients not being able to get the care that they need. You know, physicians are pushed to spend less and less time with their patients. I hear now it's even worse, that doctors, you know, aren't doing a hands-on physical exam as often as they did, you know, taking the time to sit with the patient and really go through their history or what medications they're on or really explain to them what's going on. Those kinds of things are not happening. We're pushed away from doing that. And as I practiced for about 15 years, as things were kind of getting worse and worse, you know, more hoops that you had to jump through to get care for your patients, more pressure to see more patients and spend less time with them.
Yeah.
I just said this wasn't, you know, why I went into medicine. And I also saw that many of my colleagues were leaving practice out of frustration. And so I tried to do advocacy and practice and also raise three children and felt like something had to give there. And the advocacy work just seemed to be really important. So I started out at the state level, trying to push for health reform at the state level. And then in 2008, 2009, when it was pretty much on the table at the federal level, I got very involved there. And through that experience, just saw that it's going to take more than pushing for single payer to get single payer. It's really got to be part of the broader struggle for social and economic justice.
You know, it's funny you mentioned cramming as many patients as they can. I just went for an eye checkup today. And there was a woman in there complaining that she had been waiting an hour and a half. And so everybody in the office waiting, we start talking. I'm like, somebody asked me, you know, what time was your appointment for? I said 11:15. And all of a sudden, three other people said, my appointment was for 11:15. How could they book so many people with the same time frame?
Yeah.
Again, just like you said, it's such chaos. They overbook to maximize the money coming in, but then the patients wind up suffering because they're waiting, you know, all this time. They're not getting the care they need. It's all on money, and it's not on people's health. That's not the focus anymore.
Yeah, but I mean, our little practice was struggling to survive financially because it takes so much to get the insurance companies to actually pay you for the care that you've delivered. We had people you know, our office staff constantly on the phone with the insurance companies, and then they would say that they lost the form or they need another form or it wasn't filled out right. They just, they use every trick that they can to try to delay payment, and we were really struggling, you know, in that situation. And I think primary care doctors probably have the worst time, you know, in
wow.
the situation that we're in.
Right.
And we're losing our primary care workforce, and that's really bad for our overall health as a nation. That's really a backbone of a high-quality program, is to have a strong primary care workforce.
And you know, what do you attribute this just to a hunger for profit, or do you see something more sinister afoot here? I mean, this, you know, the old saying, well, I forget how the saying goes now, but something to the effect that, you know, when so many things go screwy, after a while, you know, they have to get something right on occasion. You know, when everything is going awry constantly, you'd almost think that they want to sabotage the thing beyond just wanting to make money.
I think that, you know, and we're seeing this in a number of levels. I mean, really poor decisions are being made based on greed and not looking at the long-term consequences of those decisions. You know, if we look at how we're dealing with the environment or with the financial problems that we're in as a nation. But I think if you look at the data, we see that starting in the 1980s, when healthcare really became privatized under President Reagan, he brought Wall Street investors, you know, investment companies into the Department of Health and Human Services, and not him personally, but under his administration,
yeah.
To train them on how to take over healthcare as a profit-making field. And that was when things really started to change in terms of seeing the cost of healthcare rising, the number of uninsured rising. And so I think it's this American experiment that we've had with using the market to address health care, and we're the only industrialized nation that does that. And we thought, if you look at the literature from that time and even a little bit before, people really thought that the United States was an exception to all the other countries and that our market was going to be different and would, you know, meet our health care needs. And no, our market has done exactly what the market does. It's, you know, it's the best health care that people can afford. You know,
yeah.
If you can't afford it, you can't get it.
Right. So essentially, you know, do you want to see happen here what's happening in, you know, Canada, for example, or several European countries? You basically just walk into any hospital and no questions asked, it's automatically covered by federal funds?
Right. If you look at what works the best, you don't want to have any financial barriers to care, because that keeps people from getting care that they need or waiting until it's really too late to get the care. And so what works the best is to use your public dollars to create a health system that's there for people when they need it. So, yes, if you have a problem that you would, you know, it's not an economic decision. You would go to the hospital, you would go to the physician, go to whoever your provider was, and get that problem dealt with. And by doing that, you know, we in this country, we drive so many people to hold off until their condition is really serious. And then, of course, it's much more difficult to treat. It's more expensive to treat. The outcomes are worse. We could keep people a lot healthier if they were able to get health care up front and maintain their health. If we look at the three systems that we have in the United States right now, which is the Veterans Health Administration, which is a completely government-owned and run program, the Medicare, which is publicly funded, but people choose where they want to go for their care, or the private insurance model, you can see that the Medicare system and the Veterans Health Administration have much better outcomes. They control health care costs better than the other system does. So that's all what we're talking about, is can we just use real health policy, real evidence-based solutions to address our health care crisis? We haven't seen that.
Well, you know, I certainly agree. This system is horrific. We need a definite positive change, and to just be able to walk into a hospital and not have to deal with red tape and, you know, pocket pickers and, you know, on and on. The only drawback with this, of course, would be the obvious massive increase in taxes. Wouldn't you agree that that would definitely increase the tax burden?
Well, what we find, though, is that actually people would be paying less in taxes than they're paying right now, with, you know, between premiums and out-of-pocket expenses, and the fact that even people with health insurance in this country, if they have a serious accident or illness, find that they face financial difficulties and in many cases bankruptcy. The leading cause of bankruptcy in this nation is medical costs and medical illness, and 80% of the people who went bankrupt had health insurance. So, if instead we just raised our taxes by a few percent, because we're already paying for Medicare through our taxes, if we just raised that Medicare tax rate by a few percent, every person can have access to health care and not have to worry about whether they can afford it or not.
Yeah, that's interesting. I hadn't.
If you look at it, we're already spending 60% of our healthcare spending is already coming through public dollars.
Yeah.
We're already spending more per person per year in this country on our, with public dollars on healthcare than other industrialized nations are spending. So we're actually already paying for a universal healthcare system. We're just not getting it because we have this market-driven system that's very fragmented, and the way that we price services, the way that pharmaceuticals are priced, are just done in a way that doesn't make any sense at all.
And I think another plus to that, I know another plus to this would be, to remove the middleman, the HMOs, they drive up medical costs significantly. This would alleviate that, and that itself would bring down the cost of healthcare.
Right. I mean, the amount of money because of this, if you look at how much Medicare spends on administrative costs, they spend about 3-5% of their dollars on administration.
Yeah.
If you compare that to what we spend using this privatized system, we waste about a third of our healthcare dollar. So about 33% out of every dollar is
right
going towards marketing and administration instead of going to actual healthcare.
Right.
And we've tried regulating insurance companies in this country, and it just hasn't worked. And we're seeing that again with this new law that, when you try to impose more rules on the insurance companies, they do things to get around those rules.
They whip their lobbyists into high gear, and out the window goes that.
Or they redefine things. They've been told now they have to spend a certain percentage of premiums on actual health care, so now they're redefining what is health care and what isn't, and they're starting to put more of their administrative activities, qualify those as health care instead of administrative. So they just, they play games, and they really are the barriers to care. And it's also our for-profit hospital corporations. Those are a problem as well. They don't really care about the community. So if you have a hospital in a lower-income community that's not generating enough profit, then they'll shut that hospital down and, move into a more affluent community. We see that happening. We also see hospital corporations coming into publicly owned hospitals and running them and running them into the ground, running them into bankruptcy. They don't really care about the community. So that's one part of a single-payer system, is that you would actually give every hospital an operating budget, and they wouldn't have to worry about making profit. They would just focus on taking care of their population.
This is interesting. I was talking about how insurance companies drive up your medical costs. A few years back, I forget what happened now. I had one insurance policy that expired, and there was, a 2 or 3 week interim before my next policy had kicked in. I think I had switched companies, switched jobs or something. Anyway, so wouldn't you know it, I got an eye infection, and right in the middle of that 3 week, period there. So I went to the hospital, and, obviously I had to pay out of my pocket for this visit. And she told me, well, the good news is you only have to pay, and I forget what the figure was, but it was like one third less than it would have been if I had insurance. They actually charge you less when you don't have insurance. They charge more. It's that crazy. People don't realize how much of the high cost for medical care actually is the result of the insurance companies.
Yeah, and it's just, it's not a rational system. It's, if you ask anybody that's familiar with how services are priced, it makes no sense. One of the beauty of a single-payer system is that there would be one system, one set of rules, because that, again, is very frustrating for physician offices and hospitals, is trying to figure out with each different plan What do they cover? How much does who pay? And, you know, it's very complicated. One system would remove that, and you would no longer have the networks that insurance companies, I mean, they can limit care by restricting their networks of which providers they contract with. So if they don't want to take care of sick children, they just don't contract with a children's hospital. You know, those kinds of things that that would go away with single payer. Every provider would be in the system, and it would be up to the patients to choose where they want to go.
Right. We actually have some questions coming in via text here. Did you want to take some of those? Or?
Sure, that would be great.
Yeah, we've got this first one here from Steve in Canada. This is actually a really good question, something that I was going to be asking you myself here. He says, it would appear that Obamacare will entrench the for-profit health concept even further into the system. Do you agree, and do you see any way around it?
I absolutely agree. I mean, we've been referring to the bill that was passed under Obama, the Affordable Care Act, as corporate welfare on steroids. They're forcing people to purchase private insurance and then using about $500 billion of our taxpayer dollars over a five-year period to subsidize the purchase of private insurance. So that's going into the insurance company's pockets. They're going to use part of that money to pay their lobbyists to try to influence the law to make it, you know, more for their favor. So it did.
Sure.
This law took us in the opposite direction. It's especially concerning with the Supreme Court decision on Medicaid that states cannot be required to expand their Medicaid program. That means about half or so of the people that were supposed to gain coverage under Medicaid under this law are now not going to gain that coverage, and you know, so states can just opt out of that. Yesterday was Medicare's 47th birthday, and on that date, about 70 or so physicians and lawyers and single-payer advocates published an open letter basically saying this, that we still have a healthcare crisis, the Affordable Care Act is not the solution, and that the fastest way we could address our healthcare crisis would be to immediately expand Medicare to every person in this country and then take the time to improve Medicare.
As always, we have the illusion of fixing a problem, but it just makes the already existing one worse. It magnifies it, doesn't it?
Right, absolutely. And, you know, and we've already seen this law is very much based on the law that was passed in Massachusetts in 2006.
I was just going to say that. I'm in Massachusetts, and I've seen the casualties of this thing. I think Massachusetts serves sometimes as a testing ground for this. Let's see how much we can screw people up and make money off of. Oh, it worked great. Let's try it nationwide. And it is essentially the same program.
Yeah, yeah. So we already know that it's not going to fix the problem, that you know, there's still going to be people that are uninsured. People are still going to face financial barriers to care. I mean, there have been some interesting surveys recently coming out of Massachusetts, one from, I think, in June of this year that was done by the Harvard School of Public Health as well as the Blue Shield or Blue Cross Foundation, found that of people who have illness, about, I think, 78% of them said they've had serious problems paying for their health care, even under that law.
Wow.
A poll of the physicians in Massachusetts, I think it was last year or so, found that only 14% of the physicians in the state supported the law that you have in Massachusetts.
Right.
And,
it's a disaster.
Most of the physicians actually support single payer. Yeah.
Yeah, I can tell you a story, actually, when we get back. We got to cut to a short break. But, when we get back, I'll tell you, my next-door neighbor is going through hell with this phony system. We're going to cut to a short break, folks, so hang with us, and we'll be right back.
This land is your land. This land is my land. From California to the New York Island. This land is your land.
This coming Tuesday, Basma Farhat interviews filmmaker Sean Stone, son of Oliver Stone, who speaks about his recent trip to Iran and the dire consequences of a war with Iran. That's the People Speak radio show where we let you talk to the guests every Tuesday, 6 to 7 p.m. Pacific, 9 to 10 p.m. Eastern, here on the BBS Radio Network.
This land was made for you and me.
Okay, everybody, welcome back. That was a nice short break. Can you hear me, Margaret? I couldn't hear you during the break.
Oh, I'm here. I couldn't hear you either during the break.
Oh, okay, great. Yeah, that's unusual. Usually we can talk during the break. I don't know what happened there, but yeah, anyway, I wanted to relay this, you know, it's good to get a personal story sometimes. It adds an important touch to the thing. I have a neighbor. She's told that, you know, she's self-employed. She's told that she makes too much to get, you know, the mass health care. It's a Massachusetts assistance, you know, for low income. She makes too much for that. But she doesn't make enough to afford her own health care plan, which is, you know, $800 to $1,000 a month for the bare minimum. That's for, you know, that's not even the family plan. That's a single coverage plan. It's horrific in Massachusetts. Never mind being able to afford health care itself. You can't even afford the insurance for health care anymore. Anyway, so she makes too much for, you know, Massachusetts assistance, too little to afford her own. So guess what happens to her? They fine her. I forget what she said now, if it's 100 or, oh, it seems to me it's more than 100. It might be 150. I don't know. But anyway, nevertheless, to get a fine at all, she's getting fined every month until she can get, an insurance program. And this is their way, they claim, of solving the problem. You're getting punished for not being able to afford your own health care program, and yet they're not going to assist you because you're not making, you know, you're making not too little enough, you know, to get that assistance. What kind of a scam is this?
Yeah, it's ridiculous, and you know, the data shows that people who, even those who, like, purchase health insurance, who can afford to buy health insurance, then they don't have the money to pay the copays or the deductibles. So they've got insurance, but they can't afford to get care. That artificially hold their income down so they can qualify for a subsidy or for a particular plan. It's crazy. We're the only industrialized nation that does this. So the sooner we realize that this experiment that we've been engaged in is failing, and we have a solution. It's very simple. Expand Medicare to everyone.
And get rid of these lobby groups that are lining up politicians with fat wads of cash to pass these programs that only serve their interest and you know, hurt everybody else.
Right.
Good heavens, this is a nightmare. Anyway, we've got a bunch more questions flooding in here. We've got Mike in California. He asks, as a pediatrician, what are your concerns for children under Obamacare?
Great. Oh, good question. Well, I guess, we're really not going to see much in the way of changes under the Obama law. So children are still going to be uninsured. They're still going to face financial barriers to getting the care that they need. Those are the main things that, that are problems for children, is that their families can't afford to get them the care that they need. And
right.
That's just really not going to change significantly. I think, it was interesting. In September of 2010, there was a provision that kicked in on the six-month anniversary of the passage of the law that said that insurance companies could no longer deny new policies to children on the basis of pre-existing conditions. And so just before that provision kicked in, a number of the large insurance companies across the nation said, well, we're going to stop selling new policies to children with pre-existing new policies to children. These are individual policies, not family policies. No more individual policies to children.
Yeah.
So the Department of Health and Human Services had to work with them to try to get them to agree to cover children with pre-existing conditions. So they said, well, if they can charge more and if they can really restrict to just two small windows during the year when people can buy these policies, then they would be willing to sell them, knowing that people still won't be able to afford them or won't know when those windows are occurring. These are the games that they play, because to them, health insurance is a product. And if that product is no longer profitable, you pull it off of the shelf. And that's one of the main reasons why the system we have is not working.
It's really pathetic.
Yeah.
Anyway, let's go to, we've got another question here from Jane in California. She asks, who do you support for president in November and why?
Well, the organization I work with is Physicians for National Health Program is a nonpartisan organization. They don't endorse anybody. I think that it's pretty clear that both the Republican parties and the Democratic parties are both beholden really to the corporations and not to the people, and they're acting, to the interests of the corporations and not what the majority of people want, because we know the majority of people in the United States support single payer as well as another number of other solutions that Congress and the White House are not looking at. So I think this is really important for us to build an independent movement that pushes on whoever is in office. Personally, I think Jill Stein with the Green Party is running a great campaign, and I think that she would be an excellent candidate for people to look at.
I don't think any mainstream candidate with the two major parties are even something worth considering any longer. In fact, we've been in that position for quite some time now. It comes down to pick your puppet, let's face it.
Yeah. I mean, Obama has gotten away with things that Bush would not have gotten away with.
Sure.
And that's so funny.
I always joke, but I'm actually not joking. When Obama said, yes, we can, I think what he really meant by that is, yes, we can sucker him again.
I haven't heard that. But, yeah, I think, it's just pretty clear that both of the parties are, we're not going to, if Romney or Obama get elected this November, that's not going to be a huge difference.
No.
There'll be some difference, but.
There really never is.
No. No, we've got to, and that's the thing, is that it's been independent, or outside of the mainstream parties. Whenever it comes to significant social change in this country, it's been the outside parties that have pushed that change through impacting elections. That's one way that outside parties have power, and through changing the debate, through actually having people that will, voice what the people are talking about. What we've seen in this country is that either one of the dominant parties disappears or they adopt the platform of the outside party, and that's when we see our social change.
This next question kind of ties in with the last one. I guess pretty much you've already answered it, but nevertheless, this is from Richard in Maryland, and he asks, does Dr. Flowers think that there are any politicians left that we can trust to push for a fair healthcare system? After Kucinich caved in, I've lost faith in all politicians. I concur.
Well, I think what it points to is that it's not about the person, it's about the system. I've seen some, people, well-meaning politicians who, once they get into Congress, find out that, the game is fixed. And really, it took a lot to make Kucinich cave, but they kept trying until they finally put on enough pressure that they were able to make him do that. And so that's just the way that the game is played. And that's why I got involved with Occupy, and why I also have another project that I work on called It's Our Economy, because the way that we can start to shift power in this country is by shifting our economic power. When you have an extreme wealth divide like we have, and we're one of the top, in terms of wealth divide, we're in the top four in the world for the greatest degree of wealth inequality. When you have that degree of wealth inequality, the people that have the money have the power. So we can democratize our economy through public banks, through cooperative businesses, through participatory budgeting. There's a lot of really exciting things that are happening around the world and in the U.S. that bring wealth into communities and take it away from the corporations. And that's going to be one way that we really shift our political power.
It's got to be done.
Yeah. And it's happening. It's exciting. But people, if you aren't familiar with this, I encourage people to learn more. And we have a lot of information on itsoureconomy.us.
Oh, excellent. Itsoureconomy.us, folks. Sounds like a good website to check out. Let's go to another question here. John from Canada. He asks, how much does it cost in medical costs to have a baby, no complications, I guess, on average? What's the actual cost? Do you know? You've been out of the loop for a while, but.
I know when I had my children, which was about 20 years ago, it was about $3,000. I'm sure it's much higher than that. It also depends on, you know, where you are in the country or what insurance plan you have.
You know, I'm surprised it's that little, even just a few years ago. A root canal, you're going to pay $2,400. That's almost the same. How can a root canal be almost as much as having a baby?
Well, that was, you know, that was almost 20 years ago. And so I'm sure
20 years. Okay.
Yeah.
I'm sure. Yeah, it's got to be.
Yeah, I'm sure things are much different now.
Yeah, the sky's the limit. Cha-ching.
And, you know, and it's amazing that, you know, insurance companies will try to get away from providing maternity benefits. They'll say that if you had a cesarean section that you're higher risk and charge huge amounts to cover maternity benefits. Which is another interesting thing that our insurance companies do here in this country, which isn't done elsewhere, is that they can restrict, you know, what they will and won't cover. So in some states, they can go back through your record for 5 years, and if they find that you had a symptom, you don't even actually have to have been diagnosed with a condition, but if you have a symptom of something and then you later develop something that may have the same symptom, they can say that that was a pre-existing condition, and so they won't cover your new illness.
Oh, my goodness. They got a escape valve for everything.
Yeah.
Unbelievable. Oh, I don't know. It's really bad. I'm glad to hear that you're optimistic. You know, I tend to look at the whole mess and just want to throw your hands up in the air, but we can't do that. That's what they want.
Right. I mean, change is not going to be easy, but it is happening. I'm encouraged to see things that are happening as much as they are, because back when we started organizing the Occupation of Freedom Plaza, we thought, well, maybe this will be like a first try, and we'll have to keep trying until people finally get mobilized and wake up. And by the time that we started occupying in October, there were hundreds of occupations all across the country. So that's pretty exciting, and people are getting it. They're starting to work in their communities to build their local economies and do the things they need to do to shift the power. So. And there's, you know, as far as single payer, there's a lot of states that are really pushing on that. So there's a lot happening, and that's promising.
I remember, I'm sure you heard of Jesse Ventura.
Yes.
In fact, we're going to be getting him on the show here at some point. But he made, you know, a similar comment that one of the reasons he left politics, in fact, the main reason he left, is because, you know, he thought that getting in, he could make a positive change. But he said once he got in there and saw just how messed up things were, he says it's almost impossible.
Yeah. In this system, people lose their power unless they're going along with what the major parties want them to do. They lose their power. So it's really up to us to come together in our communities, identify the problems that exist, and then work on solutions. And, I mean, that's happening. We see people are creating affordable housing all across the country by developing community land trusts. We see in communities where there's a high rate of unemployment, people are getting together and creating worker-owned cooperatives. You know, you see more and more efforts to grow food locally. So people are really starting to make these things happen. And in each of these ways that we meet our needs outside of the corporate system becomes less and less necessary, and they weaken.
You know, you open up another can of worms there. I don't know if we want to go down there, but that's another important issue is, you know, the food. What's being offered to us in the grocery stores, the restaurants? I mean, most of it isn't fit for the dogs. And that is, of course, one of the big problems with health problems in this country. That's really the main cause is poor diet, you know. They make it almost impossible for the average person to eat a healthy meal anymore. You know, it's like, do they want you sick? You know, you want to buy organically grown stuff, you're going to pay through the nose. Most people can't afford that, and yet that's just what they need to get away from this GMO and chemically treated and, pesticide saturated. What's that?
Well, in California, it's pretty exciting if they're able to pull this off. They're trying to pass a measure that requires them to label genetically modified foods. And if California goes that way, it may have
other states might follow,
because companies don't want to just label some food for California and not label it in other places. In Europe, they do have to have these labels. Also, in Europe, they passed legislation taking toxins out of their products because, in part, they did that because they have health systems and they knew that toxins in the products would cause more health problems and greater costs.
So gee, imagine that, taking poisons out of food products. Who would have thought of such a thing?
Yeah, and here, well, in all consumer products, you know, taking them out of all products.
Oh, sure.
And they were
suntan lotion.
Right.
Yeah. Yeah.
And they were you know, gotten rid of. I mean, that's another way that having a national health program, it starts to shape the rest of public policy to create a healthier environment. But really, one of our biggest causes of health problems is also wealth inequality.
Yeah,
so
sure.
That'll be a bonus, too, if we can address that.
Definitely. Yeah, you're right. You got to get that momentum going. And once you do, just build on it. But it's getting to that point. We really got to get more people involved. And anyway, we've got a couple more questions here. We're running out of time. Let's see. We've got Shell in Canada. She asks, if you know, what percentage of the membership of the AMA support single-payer health care? Do you have any
don't know about the membership of the American Medical Association. They've actually, they're really shrinking. Only about 15% of practicing physicians belong to the American Medical Association. Most physicians belong to their own specialty organization, like I belong to the American Academy of Pediatrics, or I did when I was practicing. But we do have nationwide surveys of physicians asking them if they support a national single-payer health program. And it's interesting that in 2002, the national survey was about 49% of physicians supporting. 5 years later, in 2007, it was up to 59%. So it had grown 10% in just that five-year period. And especially if you look at emergency room physicians, psychiatrists, primary care doctors, they're much higher in the 70s and 80% in their support for a single-payer system.
Well,
we do have now the majority of physicians that support this approach, and I imagine if we did another survey, it would be even higher because things just continue to get worse.
Yeah, if you can get the doctors on your side, that's even better. That's fantastic. You're probably not a very big fan of the AMA in the first place, are you?
Well, I'm not. I mean, unfortunately, they don't have a good history when it comes to advocating for the patients. They really represent their own kind of interests.
Yeah, they pulled quite a few shenanigans, as I'm sure you're aware. I think we have time for one more question here. We've got Mary in Illinois. She asks, has Dr. Flowers received, this is an interesting question, have you received any threats or shunning from other doctors because of your criticism of the system?
Not received any threats from other doctors. It's interesting. People in their professional capacities are sometimes required to, make it clear that they don't support. I'm just thinking of times when I've given, like, a grand rounds talk. Sometimes I go to hospitals and I present a lecture to the physicians, and the hospital staff will make it very, very clear multiple times, you know, before my talk, after my talk, you know, that the views that I'm giving are not the views that the hospital, you know, do not represent what the hospital believes.
Right.
But,
sure.
Really, you know, I've had some pretty interesting discussions with physicians around the country on this. But really, when you get down to it, all the doctors know that something's wrong. It really more boils down to whether people believe that we can get this change or their own fear about what change would mean, you know, for them. Will it mean that they're better off or they're not better off? Getting over that fear.
I've had a few doctors myself, primary care physicians over the years, that confided in me. You know, you get to talk to them, you get to know them a little, you know, pretty good. And yeah, I've had several tell me how disgusted they are. They said, you know, I went to school thinking I was going to have my own practice, be my own boss, and we don't call any shots. You know, we're as powerless as our patients. You know, it's terrible. Yeah. They're told
really
what they
is.
Can do, how to. What's that?
Yeah, I mean, you go through so many years of training and trying to really have, good skills and be able to take care of your patients, and you find out that somebody with no medical knowledge is telling you what you can do and what you can't do.
Yeah, literally, no medical knowledge. Yeah, yeah.
Yeah.
You know, they can't even do home visits anymore. There's some doctors out there that would love to be able to assist, you know, elderly people who can't leave their homes or can't leave so easily. You know, they'd love to, like the old days. I remember that my mother used to have doctors come and visit when we were kids. And
right, I've done home visits. Yeah,
those days are gone. Yeah,
right. Yeah, I mean, it's just it would be such a transformation if the simplest thing we could do would be just to extend Medicare to every person in this country. We would suddenly have a national system where we could, you know, really then focus on, it's about health, not about profit, really focus on solutions and improving our healthcare system. When I was in a meeting in Congress in 2009 where there were about 150 different advocates, healthcare advocates, and the conversation was about what are some of the problems and what are solutions to them. What I heard in that room were people with real direct experience taking care of patients talking about things that would make a concrete difference. Unfortunately, yeah. None of that type of stuff actually makes it into the legislation.
Yeah, as always, that figures. Anyway, I guess we've run out of time here. It's gone by so fast, but I want to thank you for coming on. It's been a very informative show, and I want to wish you the best. Keep plugging away at this, and like you said, keep your hopes up, and sooner or later, we're going to see some major turnarounds. Once again, really quick, your websites?
Sure, thanks. Well, the one I work on is October2011.org or itsoureconomy.us, but I also want to recommend healthcare-now.org, which is Healthcare Now is the national grassroots group for single payer, and also the Physicians for National Health Program website is pnhp.org, and there's a lot of good information there about what single payer is.
Excellent. All right, thanks again.
Great, thank you so much.
Okay. You bet. Good luck in your endeavors. Okay, folks, that's it for tonight. Join us next week. We're going to have Basima back, and she's going to be interviewing Edgar Evans Casey, 94-year-old son of Edgar Casey, the famous sleeping prophet. So you don't want to miss that. Very interesting interview, and of course, Basima is going to be back. I'm sure you're going to be glad to hear her. So we'll catch you then. Take care, folks. Have a great week.
One bright sunny morning in the shadow of the stable by the relief office, I saw my people and they stood there hungry and I stood there wondering if this land was made for you and me. This land is your land, this land is my land, from California to the New York Island, the Redwood Forest to the Gulf Stream waters. Yeah, this land is made for you and me.